dear brethren and sisters, and dear young people. It's very appropriate that we should have those remarks from our brother Peter Fotheringham tonight regarding Israel, because Israel is topical from the point of view of the significant events which are taking place in the world, and also as regards this particular section which we're dealing with from Romans chapters 9 to 11. But although we are as a community very conscious of Israel, we need to be constantly reminded not only of the events which are taking place there, but of our relationship to Israel. It's necessary, of course, to keep that delicate balance too, isn't it? We don't love Jews just because we're Zionists, or we're a pro-Israeli for the sake of being pro-Israeli, or anti-Arab. That's not our situation at all, is it? But we do recognise, as we're studying from Romans, that they are God's chosen people. They are, in a national sense, elected of God for a particular purpose. They've been raised up for a purpose. Many of them have been and will be yet destroyed. But it is God's intention that a remnant shall be saved. And as we saw from our reading in Romans 11 this evening, we are in the position in which we are because we have partaken of the hope of Israel. And so we've got to keep that balance. We can't boast against the branches, nor on the other hand are we simply pro-Israeli in a nationalistic sense. It's a matter of recognising that from God's point of view, he has a purpose with that nation. And therefore we identify with that purpose, and in that sense, we identify with that nation. I think probably the chairman may have an announcement there, but I'll preempt it if he hasn't, that Brother Graham has been in Melbourne recently. Brother Graham Wixel has visited some of the Jewish shops over there, and he's brought a lot of very interesting goodies back that we might find of interest with some of our family activities. Particularly those things which can help us relate more to certain Jewish things which can be related to the Bible, particularly, for example, the Hebrew alphabet and things of that nature. And certainly it's very good if we can, in our own minds and in our own families, engender an atmosphere in which we are conscious of our relationship to Israel and trying, of course, to keep it in its proper perspective. It might also be appropriate at this stage, before we actually commence on our study and not leave it right to the end, to mention another thing that Graham brought back. I think he brought a couple of them back, and I've got one, he's got the other, and there might be one yet spare. But I believe he is able to get more of them. And that is that he found this particular Bible called the Hebrew Greek Key Study Bible, which is a Bible that I think could be of interest and value to a lot of people, because it's able to do what we might say a medium-depth study of the Bible. It is actually the King James Version, it's the authorised version. It picks up what it calls key words, sometimes two or three or four words in a verse, and it gives us the Strong's number to those verses. In the back we have the Strong's Hebrew and Chaldee dictionary, and the Strong's Greek dictionary as well. And in addition to that, there is a lexicon to the Greek and a lexicon to the Hebrew, picking up the majority of the Strong's words. In addition to that, there's a couple of pages which highlight certain information regarding the grammar, and it picks out certain words which may be in a significant text, the tense, like the middle voice, for example, which is something we come across. And at, I think, $27...
28.
Oh, Phil told me 27. Looks like I have to give it back, but I can't put that extra dollar. But at $28, that's not expensive for a book, and I'm not here to promote them as such, but there may be a lot of people who say, well, look, you know, looking up concordances and lexicons and having books spread all around the place is very heavy going. That's not for me. Leave it for Brother so-and-so or the speakers or whatever. This Bible in itself contains probably most of what many of us would want to do in looking up key words and finding the meanings of those words with Strong's and all that in the back. So Brother Graham is hopeful that more of these may be able to come through from bookshops in other states which we just don't seem to have access to here, and doubtless in due course, if you see Tony, some of them will be in the library and so forth. So we had thought, and I think this came up at an arranging brethren's meeting, Brother Kent, if I recall it, if not I imagined it, but I think we suggested that it probably wasn't a bad idea in Bible class from time to time to mention certain books that are available. Did we mention that in an AB meeting at some stage?
Oh, yes.
We did. I thought we said. I'm really not really in place in saying this anyway, although the arranging brethren haven't yet approved this particular book. But we would like to think that that everyone makes use of the facilities that are available either in our own library here or to keep their eyes open for books and project materials and the likes which are available from outside sources and to let whoever know that might be able to get them in. And it does help to keep our family activities particularly alive in this regard. Right, well, having so said, we are now due to start on Romans chapter 11. I don't anticipate, actually, that it's going to be a long study tonight. I only intend to cover the first 10 verses. It will remain to be seen as to whether my projection is true or not, but really, these particular verses are very simple. So I think it would be appropriate if just for a moment or two we review exactly where we are to this present stage. We won't go right back to the beginning, as we have traditionally done, but we'll simply remind ourselves of the fact that the theme of the book of Romans has all to do with the righteousness of God, and we must never forget that. And we've seen in the first 8 chapters that very, very beautiful exhortational section in which the righteousness of God was seen in the life of the Lord Jesus Christ and how it is to be seen in the life of the believer. The section that we're dealing with at the moment is the section going from chapters 9 to 11. We've already covered chapters 9 and 10. This evening we are starting on chapter 11. This section is the righteousness of God in relation to Israel. And that's what we said at the beginning, that it's rather appropriate that in the studying of this section we keep asking ourselves where we do stand in relation to Israel and try to keep that balance right. As far as chapter 9 is concerned, we saw there that Paul outlined God's doctrine of election. How and why he chooses or rejects individuals or nations as the instruments of his purpose. And he showed that just because a person was the descendant of Abraham didn't automatically make them eligible, didn't automatically say that they would be saved. Because in Isaac would the seed be called. But just because you were a descendant of Isaac didn't automatically save you. Because Isaac had 2 sons, Esau and Jacob. So you had to be a descendant of Jacob. And so it went on until we came to realise that God's purpose according to election is that God in his foreknowledge is able to raise up individuals or nations and use them in accordance with his infinite wisdom to perform certain aspects in regard to his purpose. Chapter 9 taught us that we must look at life through God's eyes. It's no use arguing, was it fair that he raised up a man like Pharaoh? It's almost as though he didn't give him the opportunity of doing otherwise. And of course we know that Pharaoh was the sort of individual, when put into the right circumstances, or the wrong circumstances, however you like to put it, reacted in a certain way. But God knew he would do that. And therefore, rather than query or challenging God's rightness to do a certain thing, we've got to try and look at it through God's eyes. Now of course that doesn't only apply in regard to the raising up of people in the past, but it's ourselves today. Where do we stand in relation to this? And as far as the doctrine of election is concerned, each one of us, as a result of voluntarily and willingly accepting Christ through the waters of baptism, have brought ourselves into the environment where we are a chosen one of God, and God can and will use us. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be saved. There may be some people who've converted literally hundreds to the truth, and yet may never be in the kingdom. And so what we've got to realise is that God will use people to his own end. He will use a Hitler, he will use a Pharaoh, he will use any one of us. Of course, our desire is that, as being part of the purpose of God, that we might be ourselves vessels unto honour. And it reminds us of the fact that it's not so much what we can do for the truth, although that's important enough in itself, but what the truth can do for us. And unless the truth is doing something for us, and unless the truth is changing us, unless we are allowing Yahweh as the great potter to mould us, then of course all the work we do, whilst it may be of value to the ecclesia, whilst it may be to the value of converting people to the truth, may also mean that we ourselves are never saved. And so our attitude to the truth must simply be, in the first instance, as the lesson of Romans teaches us, to allow that word and faith in that word to change us. In so doing, people will see the change, and of course we can be of benefit to others as well. And so all of us have to realise, as we study the lives of these various individuals, like David and others, some of those lost large parts of their family whilst they were very busy working in the truth. And those individuals themselves doubtless will be in the kingdom. We must recognise that we can learn from them both positively and negatively. And so this doctrine of election is a very, very important one. We might suggest, and we haven't suggested this previously, that it's well worth reading the section in Elpis Israel, where Brother Thomas deals with the scriptural doctrine of election. It's a very, very good section there. And so it reminds us that, yes, we have been chosen to perform a work. We can do that work, but are we allowing God to work in us? And so we want both of those things to apply. We want God to be able to work in us, to mould us, but that we in turn might be able to be part of his purpose and be vessels unto honour, both as far as their own lives are concerned and what we are able to perform and achieve as far as others are concerned. And so chapter 9 then dealt significantly with that doctrine of election. Of course, it was very much centred in the people of Israel. And when we came to chapter 10, Paul demonstrated there that the Jews deserved their rejection. And so whilst the nation was rejected for a time, and that the great majority of them will never be in the kingdom, the Jews were rejected because they themselves had in effect rejected God. Now this brings us to the point where chapter 11 starts tonight, and it really starts with an answer to a question where a Jew might naturally reply to what Paul has said in chapters 9 and 10 with the statement, is it to be believed then that God would cast off his people, whom he had once chosen, to whom pertained the adoption and the promises and the covenant and numerous blessings conferred upon a favoured people, and which Paul admitted? Now, would God cast these people away? Now, the objection, as will be seen by the answer given by Paul, is based on the supposition that God had rejected all his people or cast them off entirely. So there's the situation where we take up our study from chapter 11 tonight. It's answering a person who says, well, God appears to have cast off his people entirely. Is that the case? Well, let's have a look at an overview of what chapter 11 is going to present to us. And up on the screen here, we can see an overview of Romans chapter 11 from verse 1 through to verse 32, which is not the last verse, but it is the last verse as far as this particular section is concerned, verses 33 to 36 being a concluding word of praise. And so here is a summary then of how Paul is going to answer this objection. You are quite at liberty to copy those points down if you wish, but you will find them exactly like this in the notes on page 81. And you'll see the 5 points there listed around about a third of the way down the page. So this is a summary then of how Paul sets about answering this particular objection. Reminding ourselves then of what the objection is again. In brief, has God cast away his people? Now, of course, many of us will say, look, we know the answer to this, so I really don't have to follow this very closely. Well, we do really, because we want to follow Paul's reasoned argument. Because Paul is presenting to us the mind of God. It's not the end result that's important, because we all know the end result. If we wanted to know the end result, we could say, no, God hasn't cast away his people, I can sit down. But of course, in reasoning this out, Paul is presenting to us the mind of God as to how God is handling this people and why he is doing it. And that's, of course, why we end up giving expositions on verses like this, when, in fact, as I've said, the end result to all of us is well known. He answers the question in this fashion. He says, well, take myself as an example. Has God cast away his people? Well, he answers the question by showing that God had saved him, the Apostle Paul. And he was a Jew. And therefore, he could not mean that God had cast off all Jews. You see, that's what it says in verse 1. I say then, hath God cast away his people? Let it not be. For I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. Well, we'll come back and just look at that verse in a moment. The first verse is simply this. Well, if you say he's cast off all Israel, well, take me. I'm at least one. I'm a Jew. I'm an Israelite. I'm of the seed of Abraham. I'm of the tribe of Benjamin. And he hasn't cast me off. Verses 2 to 5. He shows that now, that is in the first century when he was writing, as in former times of great decline or great depletion, God had reserved a remnant. And we'll see he cites the instance of the time of Elijah, when Elijah thought that he was the only one that was left, and he was told, no, there's 7,000. So the first example was Paul himself. Verses 2 to 5 deals with the 7,000 who were preserved and reserved in the days of Elijah. Verses 6 to 10, he answers the question by showing that it was in accordance with the scriptures that some should be hardened. So whilst he would say to some, there would be the remnant, nevertheless the scripture recognised that many of them would in fact be hardened. Verses 11 to 24, he shows that the rejection was not final, but was to admit the Gentiles to the privileges of the gospel. So there was to be a benefit to others, that whilst Israel, by and large, may be hardened and rejected, it gave the opportunity for God to open up the way to the Gentiles. And you see, this is the argument we were making earlier on, wasn't it? That we could be like Israel, that God could use us in order to open up the way for somebody else, but we ourselves not be saved. And whilst that, of course, isn't intended to paint the picture of a hard, vengeful God looking down upon us, waiting to just see when we make our first slip and therefore desiring to reject us, nevertheless, it makes us recognise that we shouldn't feel complacent and think, well, we are in the truth and we are just automatically better than the rest of the world. That's what the Jews thought, and of course, they were wrong. So verses 11 to 24 is part of the argument that the rejection was not final, but was to admit the Gentiles to the privileges of the gospel. And then the fifth point, he shows in verses 25 to 32 that the Jews would yet be returned to favour with God, so that it could not be objected that God had finally and totally cast off his people, or that he had violated his promises. So that's really the outline of Romans 11. And I find, and I hope most of you find too, that it's good to be able to look at a chapter like that and say, ah, so that's where he's going in the course of his argument. I know many of us may have read Romans 11 verse 1 before, and I say that have God cast away his people? And we read, God forbid, for I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham of the tribe of Jacob. And we think, well, what's he say that for? Oh, well, he's just introducing himself now. What's the argument? But in fact, there is already an argument in verse 1. And if we can see it in this context, that he is in fact answering this objection, then verse 1 is a good starting point and a very powerful one. So let's start there. Verse 1, and we will read it again. I say then, the NIV translates it as, I ask then. So he's anticipating the question in the mind of a Jew. He's anticipating the question, has God cast away? Has God cast away his people? If you happen to be glancing at the notes at the same time as you're reading the text, you'll see against the word cast away there a note which says that the Greek is apotheo, that is used in the middle voice. It signifies to thrust from oneself, to cast off by a way of rejection, and it quotes Vine as the authority. This matter of the middle voice, now most of us don't get too heavily involved in tenses or voices or things like that, but we have on occasions in the past been caused to comment upon this use of the middle voice in Greek, where one does something to oneself. I just noticed with interest that in this Bible that we were promoting a moment ago, the Hebrew Greek Key Study Bible, that if you happen to look at Hebrews chapter 11 verse 1, it says, I say that hath God cast away, and against the word cast away, it's got a little letter up the top. What's that, a thing that goes up the top? Not free something, what's the one that goes up the top? Subscript, is it? Superscript, got it. Superscript, a little series of letters up the top, which says A-O-M. And if you look up page 1759, that's what I was right. No, I couldn't be right. 1659. No. Anyway, it's somewhere at the end of Revelation. Here it is. What page was it? There's no page number there. Something before 1570, anyway. It says here, AOM means aorist middle voice. So you see, it's very useful grammar, isn't it? It actually picks up comments like that, which I don't know of any other translations that actually will comment on a thing like that. So, you know, when you read something like this, this is used in the middle voice, a translation or a, it's not so much a translation, but a compilation like this can be very useful, and I was interested to see that there in the text. Well, what's the significance of it? Well, as the comment says here, used in the middle voice, it signifies to thrust away something from oneself. I am thrusting it away from myself. It sort of adds an emphasis to it. Has God thrust away from himself his people? So they are styled his people, but he is thrusting them away from himself. So you see, it's quite a vigorous, it's quite a definite sort of statement that God is totally pushing away people that are rightly his. Well, this could not be the case. And it doesn't hurt us to look up one or two of these references here, like Leviticus chapter 26, verses 44 and 45. I just remind you, as I said earlier, that just because we know the end result of this and we know what the answer to the question is, there is, of course, nevertheless, a lot of benefit in following through the reasoning by which Paul is able to prove this and the subsequent and consequent exhortations that come out of it. So in Leviticus chapter 26, verse 44, he says, "And yet for all that, when they be in the land of their enemies, I will not cast them away, neither will I abhor them to destroy them utterly, and to break my covenant with them, for I am Yahweh their Elohim. But I will, for their sakes, remember the covenant of their ancestors, whom I brought forth out of the land of Egypt, in the sight of the heathen, that I might be their God. I am Yahweh." And so he makes it very clear, doesn't he, that he's doing this for the sake of the fathers, an argument which Paul himself has also picked up in his previous chapters. We might like to compare that with Romans 11, verse 28. For we read there, "As concerning the gospel, they are enemies for your sakes, but as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sakes." So Paul is making his argument very clear. No, God has not totally rejected Israel. It was never his intention to totally reject Israel. And the reason was because of the promises that he made to the fathers. And it's because of the promises made to the fathers of Israel that we, as Gentiles, are able to be here tonight. And we must never forget that. For as many of you as have been baptized into Christ, says Galatians, and it ends with the note, are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promises. So he makes the point that, back in chapter 11 and verse 1, that he himself is an Israelite, he is of the seed of Abraham, and he is of the tribe of Benjamin. And if you care at your leisure to read through the notes there, you'll see some other references which are quite significant in relationship to these terms. Perhaps one which I think is maybe a little more significant than may appear on the surface is the fact that there was one other individual in the New Testament who was specifically called an Israelite. That, of course, was the man Nathanael back in John's Gospel in chapter 1. And on what basis was he called an Israelite? Well, when we glance back at John chapter 1, verse 47, Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and saith of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no guile." And he goes on to explain to him in verse 51, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, hereafter you shall see heaven opened, and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." And so it was because Nathanael had perceived the truth and had come to appreciate the principles of God manifestation that he could be an Israelite indeed. Paul himself had to go through a transition. He was an Israelite after the flesh, but it was only when he saw that physical manifestation, which was the turning point in his life, and which later, of course, became a mental manifestation as well, in which he came to accept the truth, that he could likewise say that he was an Israelite indeed. Doubtless, however, in Romans 11, verse 1, his argument is particularly, though, that he was born of the stock of Israel and, in a physical sense, was an Israelite. But it is interesting to pick up the fact that here was a man who had been changed from simply an Israelite after the flesh to an Israelite after the spirit. So that's the argument then in verse 1. You couldn't say all Israel's cast off because I'm an Israelite and I haven't been cast off. Any comments on that verse? All right, we move on to the next section then. In verses 2 to 5, in which the argument is now going to show that now, as in the time Paul was writing, as in former times of great declension, that is decline, God had reserved a remnant. And so he says in verse 2, God hath not cast away his people which he foreknew. So he's totally denying then the idea suggested that God had cast away his people. He says, watch ye not what the scripture saith of Elias. Watch ye not is rather an antiquated sort of expression, isn't it? It can be expressed as, don't you know what the scripture says in the passage about Elijah, how he appealed to God against Israel, as we've got it in the NIV. Or the Greek text starts with the word or don't you know? Don't you know about the incident involving Elijah? Well, what was the incident involving Elijah? We go back to 1 Kings chapter 19, and we find the place from which he's quoting. 1 Kings chapter 19 and verse 10. And he said, I have been very jealous for Yahweh Elohim of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. So here is a case of a man like Elijah, thinking that God had cast away his people and that he was the only one that was left. Verse 18 says, and Yahweh responds with the words, yet have I left me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which hath not kissed him. And so he had to learn that there were yet 7,000 that Yahweh had reserved. Let's see how Paul uses this particular argument. Verse 2 simply says, don't you know about the incident with Elijah? Verse 3 quotes that passage which we just read from 1 Kings chapter 19 and verse 10. Verse 4 picks up the answer taken from the 1 Kings 19 and verse 18. So what he says in verse 4 then is, I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. In other words, he says, I have cause to remain. It was a work of Yahweh, a work of Yahweh himself, that such a faithful remnant was preserved. And he says, they've not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. Now, of course, the question is, why hadn't they bowed the knee to the image of Baal? Well, they hadn't bowed the knee to the image of Baal because it wasn't as a result of any act of works or anything which they had done out of sheer willpower. It was because they believed that Baal was wrong, that they believed that Yahweh was the true God. In other words, it was based upon faith. There's a comment in the notes which I think is Brother Carter's comment. That's the next one on. We simply make the comment though, and it's here somewhere regarding faith. Can't see it for looking, but it's virtually what I just said then. It's over the page on page 83. It's a comment which actually we've got on verse 6, but it would apply probably more or just equally to verse 5. A little way down on page 83. One might say that the 7,000 in Elijah's day were reserved because of works. They did not worship Baal. But why did they not worship Baal? And the answer is because of faith in Yahweh. And so Elijah had to learn the fact that there were 7,000 who had still remained faithful in the sense that they had not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. The important point, of course, which comes out and mentioned in verse 5 is this. Even so then, at this present time also, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. And this certainly picks up some of those significant words which we've looked at in our previous studies. A remnant according to the election of grace. The remnant, therefore, were reserved by a gracious and a merciful choosing, not by any merit of their own, not because they were the seed of Abraham, or because of their works. And from a personal point of view, I find that word grace one of the most powerful words in the scriptures. We've doubtless all got verses and words and things like that which seem to affect us, but I think the word grace is one of the most powerful ones that we come across. I think I probably first noted it in that context some years ago when I studied Ephesians, and we saw how powerfully it went through the epistle to the Ephesians. Ephesians starts with it and finishes with it, and the word grace becomes a significant word right through there. And we're reminded, and if you've still got your notes right back on chapter 1, that back there we've got some notes on the word grace in the context of the opening salutation. So you might just like to glance back there on verse 5, page 3, to note on verse 5 that the word grace, which is the Greek charis, which means favour, particularly the unmerited divine favour which Paul and all the saints have received in a knowledge of the gospel of God. And we comment that it's an important word in the epistle and list off the occurrences. Well, you see, we haven't really seen it since about chapter 6, but here it comes up again now in Romans chapter 11 verse 5 and in verse 6, and we note that it occurs 4 times. So you see, it's another important word in the epistle. And in the sense that it has this idea of unmerited divine favour, of course it's a very important part of Paul's argument here in Romans chapter 11. So he says then, in concluding his argument on this second section, verses 2 to 5, even so then at this present time also there is a remnant according to the election, according to the choosing by God's unmerited favour. And if we can't apply that to ourselves and recognise that our presence here this evening is not entirely part of that argument, because he's talking about the preserving of Israel, but shortly he's going to show how that it gave the opportunity for Gentiles to be brought in, but it's still on the basis of God's grace. And when one considers the unmerited divine favour which we have received, it makes us, of course, take God much more seriously. It makes us take life much more seriously. It makes us take the truth much more seriously. And it makes us realise that when we are studying these things, we are not just coming here to study a textbook and to say, oh, I've learnt this word and I've learnt that word, or I knew that before, or I don't have to listen at this stage, or I can or I can't, all these sort of things. We are considering the words of God, reminding us of the fact that not one of us deserves to be here, not one of us deserves to be in the position we are, and therefore because of that, we've got so much to be thankful to God for, and to be reminded that God is desirous of extending his grace and continuing to extend his grace. We may not always be able to see it. We may interpret the circumstances of life as saying, well, God has forsaken us. But no, God in his wisdom may be chastening us, he may be refining our characters in certain ways, but it's always according to his grace. And so he picks up the argument and uses it now as an introduction to this next section, verses 6 to 10, that in fact it was in accordance with the scriptures that some should be hardened, and that even though God's grace has always been extended both to natural Israel and to spiritual Israel, to whoever would desire to be amongst that remnant, nevertheless we must acknowledge the fact that the majority of people amongst Israel were hardened. So we pick up the argument then from verse 6, where he says, and if by grace, then is it no more of works, otherwise grace is no more grace. I think you'll find that virtually all other translations omit the latter part of that verse, which goes on to say, but if it be of works, then is it no more grace, otherwise work is no more work. I haven't found it in too many translations. I suppose it's about time we ask for our round of translations again, isn't it? So I've dived on over there. What does that say on verse 6? Does it leave out the latter part of verse 6, Andrew? It just leaves out. What does it say, actually? Same as what the notes say, I suppose. Sorry? Verse and a footnote. What does the footnote say there?
The footnote says, but if my favour is no longer from works, otherwise the favour is no longer favour. But if works no longer favour, otherwise work is no longer favour.
That's the footnote, says that.
Yeah.
And what does it say about the footnote?
Just says the footnote.
Just this footnote. Doesn't it say some manuscripts put it like that or something to that effect? Sorry? It says that. Have you got a different edition from him? Does it say the Vatican manuscript says that?
Yes.
Beg your pardon?
Yes, it does.
Yes, it does. Right. So it says the Vatican manuscript puts that in, but in the text up the top, it leaves it out. We're making hard work of this, but we'll get there. It leaves it out.
Yes.
Right. Good. Thank you.
Young
Zittrel leaves it in. Oh, we don't want too many of those. We want some support. Any others leave it in? We've got any others that leave it in? Pannon here tonight? Pannon leaves it out. Yours? I'm not going to say what it is because I won't get it right. Leaves it out. New American Standard Bible. Right. So, majority leave that last part of the verse out. It seems as though it's all right, but it just becomes a little bit cumbersome. Actually, verse 6 is one of those parenthetical verses, and we haven't used parenthetical for a few weeks, so it's good that we put it back in again. It's really, you can actually leave verse 6 out, and the argument flows right through from verses 5 to 7. For example, let's read, say, from verse 5 through to 7 and leave verse 6 out. Even so then, at this present time also, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. What then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for, but the election hath obtained it, and the rest were blinded. But what is verse 6 saying? Well, verse 6 is emphasising that if the remnant are according to the election of grace, then it can't be by works. And why does he put that in there? Well, because he wants to remind these people that the real argument is not just the pros and cons of where the Jews fit into it, but the real argument of Romans is justification by faith or justification by works. And whilst it appears that for the last few verses anyway, or chapter or so, he may be getting away from that basic theme, he doesn't want to really lose sight of it. And he wants us to remember too that we are a remnant according to the election of grace, and if by grace, then is it no more of works. And of course it takes us back to the point we were making earlier, that yes, there must be works in the truth, and it is desirous that we do works, and our works may be instrumental in saving others. But if we don't appreciate the grace of God, and if we're not justified by faith, then of course works are of no avail. And his use of works here, Paul's use of works, is obviously in the context of works of law, where they thought they were being justified by the law of Moses. So verse 6 then is simply emphasising it's by grace and not by works, because otherwise, he says, grace is no more grace. Or as the Diaglot says, but if by favour, no longer from works, otherwise the favour is no longer a favour.
John, Those were left out by some manuscripts, so he's got the three different sections.
Graham, two things arise out of that. One, did you hear it at the back? You did. That's good, because it was rather difficult to report, to repeat, I mean. And two, I don't happen to have Bullinger, but it sounds as though it's very good. I've got, you know, Bullinger's Companion Bible, but not that particular one, so I was unaware of that. So Graham's comment, I think, is a valuable one to those who might like to avail themselves of that particular facility. Is that book still readily available? Or what is it called? Bullinger's... what's it called?
Sure.
Lexicon to the...
Is it Bullinger or on the front?
Is it Hebrew and Greek? Or just
no, only Greek.
Only Greek?
Greek.
Bullinger's Greek Lexicon or something. That's what it's known as. What's that mean, Tony? You got them in the library?
No, I haven't got
them. So yes, it's right, and no, you haven't got it. But can you get them?
Yes.
No.
It is much easier to follow than vines, by the way.
Much easier to follow than what?
Than vines.
Than vines,
some
yeah.
Some people find vines a little bit difficult to go through, but following is a lot easier to read. And,
yeah.
And then it has quite a big section to back through them.
Vine wouldn't, of course, attempt to categorise what you were saying about verses that are left out and put in. He just gives descriptions of meanings of words as he sees them. Sometimes he's very, very good, and sometimes he's a bit off beam, isn't he? But so is Bullinger, isn't he?
Yes.
Yes. So we've got to be cautious of any reference books that we use, and judge them on the basis of what we know to be the truth, and as to whether they are safe to use or... or have to be used with extreme caution. Anyway, thanks for the comment, Graham. Well, we're in the middle then of looking at this section, verses 6 to 10, which is the one that we're going to simply complete this evening. Verse 7 really asks, well, it's got 3 points there. What then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for. That's the first point. So he says, Israel sought justification by works of law. That's what they were trying to obtain. They were trying to obtain it by merit. So he says, Israel has not obtained that which he seeketh for. So they were seeking justification by works of law. The second point is, but the election hath obtained it. And thirdly, he says, the rest were blinded. So Israel sought then the grace or the favour of God and salvation by obedience to works of law, but they didn't find it. The election, on the other hand, hath obtained it. In other words, those chosen ones did obtain what Israel as a whole so earnestly sought, justification in the sight of God. The rest of them, they were blinded. And the word blinded means to petrify, to cover with a thick skin, to become callous. I think the word petrify there means to petrify as in petrified rocks and things like that, not petrify as in the way in which we may loosely use it when a person says, I'm petrified, and that means I'm frightened. But I think what the word really means is that they've just gone like a petrified rock, I suppose. So don't read the word petrified to mean to frighten. That's just a sort of a strange usage we have. But to petrify in the sense of to cover with a thick skin, to become callous. The NIV says that the others were hardened. In other words, the vast majority of the nation became hardened by the circumstances and thus were impervious to the appeal of Yahweh. So that's quite an important verse, verse 7. 3 points in it. Israel generally sought God's acceptance, salvation, favour by works of law, and they didn't find it. Those who are classified as the election, those who were the remnant according to the election of grace, they did find it, they sought it, and they found justification by faith. What did the rest do? Well, the rest became hardened. And of course, he's talking about a situation in his own day. The rest were blinded. They became callous. They became impervious to the effects of the word. Brother Carter's comment is quite relevant here. He says, how often do we find that punishment corresponds in its form to that mode of life which man has chosen? That's a very nice way of putting an expression which sometimes is used, that God makes the punishment fit the crime, which is a, you know, it's a, not a good way of putting it. This is a much more delicate way of putting it, I think, in more acceptable Bible terms. How often do we find that punishment corresponds in its form to that mode of life which man has chosen? Because the early Christians did not receive the love of the truth, God sent them strong delusion that they should believe a lie. Israel had such an obsession for their own mode of attaining to righteousness that God shut them up to their own folly. They might have known, for their own prophets had warned them of the danger. Paul combines two of the predictions of the prophets in verse 8. Now that aspect there of God sending them a strong delusion they should believe a lie, in which Brother Carter says, how often do we find that punishment, and the punishment of course is the delusion, corresponds in its form to that mode of life which man has chosen. What was the mode of life that brought upon it God's punishment in the form of a delusion? Yeah, question. What was it? What's he saying? Any suggestions? What is it that caused the delusion? Yes. So what did they receive? What did they go for? Yes. How would you describe that?
You go around in one,
yes, yes. You're going well, but I want a particular thing which is a bit obscure, but if you can get it, that'll be really good. But well, yes. Actually, I'm leading up to a quote from Eureka, which I found a very useful one to understand how it is that the scripture can say that God sends a delusion upon people. That just seems to be unfair. We might that the punishment, of course, is the delusion, corresponds in its form to that mode of life which man has chosen. What was the mode of life that brought upon it God's punishment in the form of a delusion? Yes, question. What was it? What's he saying? Any suggestions? What is it that caused the delusion? Yes. So what did they receive? What did they go for? Yes. How would you describe that?
You go around in one, three curves of the idea.
Yes. Yes. You're going well, but I want a particular thing which is a bit obscure, but if you can get it, that'll be really good. But yes. Actually, I'm leading up to a quote from Eureka, which I found a very useful one to understand how it is that the scripture can say that God sends a delusion upon people. That just seems to be unfair. We might have come to grips with God hardening Pharaoh's heart, and we say, well, all right, you had that sort of heart, but is it right that God should send a delusion on people? Well, see, Brother Carter is saying that God makes the punishment, which is the delusion. You know, 2 Thessalonians 2 says, God shall send them strong delusion, they will believe a lie. He makes it correspond to the mode of life. Now, what was the mode of life that they were leading that prompted God to send them a delusion? Or, at least for the scriptures say that God sent them a delusion.
They want
to remember. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Say it in a nice loud voice and make everyone can hear. And what did that do to them?
Made
them drunk and it made them delirious. That's correct. Help us, Israel. No. Eureka, Volume 1, page 25. Delusion and delirium have a near and intimate relationship. And the stronger the delusion, the more intense the delirium. In the apocalypse, therefore, when the strong delusion
in its effect upon the nations of Christendom comes to be signified or represented, they are described as having been made drunk and as being drunk. Now, these comments Brother Thomas makes spring out of quotes from Isaiah and also from Thessalonians. The quote in Isaiah, for example, Isaiah chapter 25, Isaiah 25 and verse 6. And in this mountain shall Yahweh of hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrows, or marrow, of wines on the lees well refined, and he will destroy in this mountain the face of the covering cast over all people, and the veil that is spread over all nations. So the covering and the veil spread over all nations is that which Paul speaks about in Thessalonians. God sends them a strong delusion. But why is this veil or the covering spread over their face? Well, because they have been partaking of the wine of Babylon, the wines well refined, the strong wines. So if we partake of the wine of Babylon, then we will become deluded. And this, of course, brings us back to Romans 1. God gave them up, didn't he? Three nights. He gave them up. He let them do it. They said, that's the way we want to go. God said, you go that way. They went that way. They got drunk. And their mind became deluded. So inasmuch as God let them do it, the scripture can say God sent them a strong delusion. But he didn't get them and deliberately put a veil over their faces or over their eyes or over their minds and say, I don't care what you do, I'm not going to let you see. They were drunk and they couldn't see. And a person who is delirious, as I think it was Andrew used the term, that you get too drunk and you get the delirium tremens? Delirium. What is it? How do you spell it?
T-R-E-M-E-N-S.
I don't know what. Shaking or something, isn't it? Is it? D-T. That's right. That's what they call it, don't they? Well, that is because one is drunk. When one is drunk, one naturally becomes very easily deluded. So when we read then that God sent them a delusion, he simply allowed the effect of the intoxication of the wine of Babylon to take its natural effect, and they became deluded. So Brother Carter says it in that very nice and very delicate way when he says, how often do we find that punishment, that would be delusion, corresponds in its form to that mode of life that is delirium, which man has chosen because he wanted to get drunk with the wine of Babylon. And so in this first century, in the time when Paul was writing, already many were departing from the faith. And they were going back to Judaism, they were going to a form of Gnosticism, they were going in all sorts of directions. And consequently then, even in Paul's time, there was just this situation which he'd spoken about in verse 2, I think it was, when he said, what did he say, even at this present time, we read it a few moments ago, verse 5, even so then at this present time also there is a remnant according to the election of grace. So he was suggesting at that time, even the majority of people who maybe had accepted Christ were beginning to go away. And they were becoming deluded. So this really springs out of the comments on verse 7. What then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for. So Israel tried to get justification by works of law. The election, who had accepted God's grace, did obtain it. And what about the rest of them? They were blinded, or they were hardened. And how were they hardened? They were hardened by God. God sent them a strong delusion. How did he do it? He just gave them up. And he gave them up to their own way of life, which automatically led to them being deluded. Did that sort of all sound quite reasonable by the time we got the end of it? Sometimes these lengthy things almost become like a conundrum. And did it sound all right, Graham?
Yeah.
What? At least amusing, if nothing else. Right, okay. Right. Now, in verse 8, as Brother Carter has just said, Paul now combines two quotations which he says predicted this. I think I'll just take it straight from the notes at this stage on page 83. Paul's words are taken from Isaiah 29 verses 9 and 10 and Deuteronomy 29 verse 4. It says there that God hath given them the spirit of slumber. God gave them up to a spirit of stupor, the NIV and the Diaglot says. The word slumber has the idea of stupor or lethargy. One authority comments, it means any emotion or any influence, whatever that, shall benumb the faculties and make them insensible. And of course the typical symbol of the scripture is the strong wine, the wine of Babylon, which will intoxicate. The context of these two passages is significant, and we've already examined these two contexts before. The context of the passage from Isaiah is of intoxication, but not with wine. The people were intoxicated with false doctrine because they'd lost their vision and were no longer able to discern right doctrine. The outcome was evident in Paul's day, as described in verse 13 of Isaiah 29. This people draw near me with their mouth and with their lips to honour me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. So it was simply as a result of law, tradition, that they had a fear toward God. Now Paul had previously quoted from this same chapter at verse 16, back in Romans chapter 9 and verse 20, regarding the symbol of the clay and the potter. So you see, it could be well worth the study of going back and looking at Isaiah 29. I don't intend to do it in the class, and just looking at the context of that chapter to see why it is that Paul should pick it up several times going through here in this section. But we notice it's related to the intoxication of the nation and the fact that they later became blinded, hardened and deluded. The second part of the reference used by Paul is from Deuteronomy 29 verse 4. And from the section dealing with the covenant in the land of Moab, and again, Paul had previously quoted from this, back in chapter 10 and verses 4 to 8. In this place, Moses remonstrates with Israel that despite the fact that they had witnessed the mighty hand of Yahweh, they did not have eyes to perceive or ears to hear the truth of the wonders they had seen, and so developed faith toward their deliverer. And so that's the comments, briefly, on verse 8. Two more verses then to complete this particular section, and again a significant quotation. In verse 9 we have a quotation from Psalm 69 verses 22 and 23. This psalm of course is a messianic one. You're all looking for the next page, aren't you? Now you haven't got it. I've got half of it here, but it hasn't been completely typed, so I don't hand out pages until they're completely typed. So, all being well, you'll get it next time. This psalm is not only messianic, but also foretells the sufferings of the Lord and his sacrifice. If in fact we go back to Psalm 69, we'll see some verses there which are quite well known and which show to us it's obviously a messianic psalm. Psalm 69, for example, verse 21. They gave me also gall for my meat, and in my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink. Now, obviously, a reference to Christ's sacrifice. When we come to verse 22, we have the words now quoted by Paul. Let their table become a snare before them, and that which should have been for their welfare, let it become a trap. Let their eyes be darkened, that they see not, and make their loins continually to shake. And so those preceding verses spoke of Christ being given vinegar to drink, and verses 22 and 23 follow as a pronouncement of retribution for their sins. So not losing sight then of the overall argument here, God is saying that all Israel was never intended to be saved because they sought salvation by the wrong means. There was a remnant who took hold of God's grace and understood the principle of the righteousness which comes by faith. They therefore become the elect. What about the rest? Well, they become hardened because God has given them up because they wanted to go their own way. They went their own way. They became drunk. They became deluded. They became hardened. And therefore, God punished them because of that. And Psalm 69, which we just quoted from, says exactly that same thing. And so verse 9 of Romans 11 says that, and verse 10 says the same thing. I'll just conclude then with a quote from Brother Carter. He comments on this section as follows. In reference to the term about their table, let their table be made a snare. He says the table in the first application is put for the feast spread thereon, and indicates the prosperity and privilege which proved their undoing. In false security they were ensnared. But what essentially was Israel's table? Through Malachi, God says to Israel, ye offer polluted bread upon mine altar. And ye say, wherein have we polluted thee? In that ye say, the table of the Lord is contemptible. And if ye offer the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? Israel had a law with a sacrificial system. This was their privilege, and it should have been their guide. Instead of allowing it to guide them, they prided themselves upon their exclusiveness as a nation and pursued ceremonial cleanness to the neglect of the weightier matters of the law. Their mind became focused on the details of the ritual and lost sight of its meaning. Their table became a snare. Requital came in a blind trust in law, and they were given up to their own desires. Their understanding was darkened, and the law became a burden because a burden they could not bear. With bowed backs and darkened eyes, they staggered and fell. They crucified the Lamb of God, and God cursed their blessings. And it's a good note to finish on, because that expression in Malachi, and it wouldn't hurt us to turn back to that, picking up this idea of the table of the Lord, and Brother Carter's very pertinent comments there, remind us of the situation which we find ourselves in today. He said, here was a people who had pursued ceremonial cleanness to the neglect of the weightier matters of the law. And whilst we don't make a great play upon ceremonial things in our worship today, nevertheless there can be a ritual of simply attending meetings and doing certain duties, and neglecting, of course, in our mind the weightier principles. And if so, it falls under the condemnation that Malachi speaks of in chapter 1, where he answers their question, how have we despised thy name, in verse 6. And the answer comes in verse 7, when he says, and I'm reading this from, I think it's sort of the Revised Standard Version, but it's a combination of translations, by offering polluted bread upon mine altar. And you say, how have we polluted it? By thinking that the table of Yahweh can be despised. And when ye offer the blind for sacrifice, is that not evil? And when you offer the lame and sick, is that not evil? Offer it now unto thy governor. Will he be pleased with thee, or show thee favour? Said Yahweh of hosts. So he says, try the service you're giving to me on your earthly master, and see how it is accepted. But the interesting thing which comes out of it, of course, is that word contemptible, which is a very strong word in the English, but actually literally means to treat lightly. It's not quite as obnoxious as it sounds in the King James Version. To treat lightly. We are treating the table of Yahweh lightly. And of course, we can imagine the situation where if we went to work and, well, fell asleep at our desk, we wouldn't last too long. But if we go to a meeting and fall asleep, well, that's a different matter. But it's not a different matter, is it? I mean, if we go to work and we only concentrate for half the day, then we will be dismissed. If we open up our Bibles and start studying and only half concentrate, then that doesn't seem to matter. Isn't that treating Yahweh lightly? It certainly is. And of course he says, you are treating the table of Yahweh lightly. And of course, as we've seen here, the table, whilst in the first sense it literally means a place where a feast was placed, of course it's that symbol of communion, of relationship with. And because everything earthly is so tangible, and our earthly master, as Malachi says, is there, try offering it to your governor. No, you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't stand in front of your governor and fall asleep while he's talking to you, and then tune in half the time and not half, the other half of the time, you wouldn't dare do it. But you see, Yahweh is not visible. He's not present. It's tedious. You know, this is what the flesh says. And it's very serious when we come to think about it, because the grace of God says none of us deserves the privilege of being able to come together around the Word of God. And yet we can so very easily take it lightly, can't we? And this is where Israel failed. They sought salvation by the wrong means. You say, oh, but that's not me. I'm seeking it by the right means. Well, we've got to be careful, don't we? Because if we are seeking it by the right means, we will bring everything into perspective. And whilst it's easy to condemn the Jew for seeking salvation by works of law, we can, in our own funny way, be doing it ourselves and think that because we do our daily reads, because we go to the meetings, we are just automatically being all right. Well, to come back then to the point as far as Romans 11 is concerned, we've concluded at verse 10, which is halfway through Paul's answer to the Jews, who says, has God cast away his people? He cited his own case to illustrate the point that they couldn't all have been cast away because he'd been accepted. In former times there'd been great declension that God had reserved a remnant, as in Elijah's time. And furthermore, verses 6 to 10 show to us that it was in accordance with scriptures that such should be the case. The scripture pointed out there would be, remember just those three instances from Romans chapter 11 and verse 7, that Israel by and large had sought it on the wrong basis. The election had obtained it because they'd accepted God's grace, and the rest were blinded or hardened. God willing, in our next class, we'll move on to see the way in which we have become now a privileged group as Gentiles, that whereas Israel had been nationally, generally rejected for the time being, it was an opportunity for God's grace to be extended to us.
Those in the back here.
We'll conclude this evening together, brethren and sisters, by singing hymn 160, which will be followed by prayer.